William Morrow and Harper Audio present A Deadly Affair, Unexpected Love Stories from the Queen of Mystery by Agatha Christie. Performed by David Suchet, Hugh Fraser, Joan Hickson, and Judith Boyd.
The King of Clubs. Truth, I observed, laying aside the daily newsmonger, is stranger than fiction. The remark was not perhaps an original one. It appeared to incense my friend. Tilting his egg-shaped head on one side, the little man carefully flicked an imaginary fleck of dust from his carefully creased trousers and observed, "How profound! What a thinker is my friend Hastings!" Without displaying any annoyance at this quite uncalled-for jibe, I tapped the sheet I had laid aside. "You've read this morning's paper?" "I have, and after reading it, folded it anew, symmetrically. I did not cast it on the floor as you have done, with your so lamentable absence of order and method." That's the worst of Poirot. Order and method are his gods. He goes so far as to attribute all his success to them. "Well, then you saw the account of the murder of Henry Reedburn, the impresario? It was that which prompted my remark. Not only is truth stranger than fiction, it is more dramatic. Think of that solid middle-class English family, the Oglanders. Father and mother, son and daughter, typical of thousands of families all over this country. The men of the family go to the city every day, the women look after the house. Their lives are perfectly peaceful and utterly monotonous, and last night they were sitting in their neat suburban drawing room at Daisy Mead, Streatham, playing bridge. Suddenly, without any warning, the French window bursts open and a woman staggers into the room. Her grey satin frock is marked with a crimson stain. She utters one word, 'Murder,' before she sinks to the ground insensible. It is possible that they recognise her from her pictures as Valerie St. Clair, the famous dancer who has lately taken London by storm."
"Is this your eloquence or that of the Daily Newsmonger?" inquired Poirot.
"Well, the Daily Newsmonger was in a hurry to go to press and contented itself with bare facts, but the dramatic possibilities of the story struck me at once." Poirot nodded thoughtfully.
"Wherever there is human nature, there is drama. But it is not always just where you think it is. Remember that. Still, I too am interested in their case, since it is likely that I shall be connected with it."
"Indeed? Oh, yes. A gentleman rang me up this morning and made an appointment with me on behalf of Prince Paul of Morania." "But what has that to do with it?"
"You do not read your pretty little English scandal papers, the ones with the funny stories and a little mouse has heard, or a little bird would like to know. See here."
I followed his short, stubby finger along the paragraph. "Whether the foreign prince and the famous dancer are really affinities, and if the lady likes her new diamond ring."
"And now to resume your so dramatic narrative," said Poirot. "Mademoiselle St. Clair had just fainted on the drawing-room carpet at Daisy Mead, you remember?"
I shrugged.
"And as a result of Mademoiselle's first murmured words when she came round, the two male Oglanders stepped out, one to fetch a doctor to attend to the lady who was evidently suffering terribly from shock, and the other to the police station, whence after telling his story he accompanied the police to Montdésir, Mr. Reedburn's magnificent villa, which is situated at no great distance from Daisy Mead. There they found a great man, who by the way suffers from a somewhat unsavory reputation, lying in the library with the back of his head cracked open like an eggshell." "Oh, I have cramped your style," said Poirot kindly. "Forgive me, I pray. Ah, here is Monsieur le Prince."
Our distinguished visitor was announced under the title of Count Feodor. He was a strange-looking youth, tall, eager, with a weak chin, the famous Morenberg mouth, and the dark, fiery eyes of a fanatic.
"Monsieur Poirot."
My friend bowed.
"Monsieur, I am in terrible trouble, greater than I can well express."
Poirot waved his hand.
"I comprehend your anxiety. Mademoiselle St. Clair is a very dear friend, is it not so?"
The prince replied simply,
"I hope to make her my wife."
Poirot sat up in his chair and his eyes opened. The prince continued,
"I should not be the first of my family to make a morganatic marriage. My brother, Alexander, has also defied the emperor.
We are living now in a more enlightened days, free from the old caste prejudice. Besides, Mademoiselle St. Clair, in actual fact, is quite my equal in rank. You have heard hints as to her history. There are many romantic stories of her origin, not an uncommon thing with famous dancers. I have heard that she is the daughter of an Irish charwoman, also the story which makes her mother a Russian Grand Duchess.
But the first story is, of course, nonsense, said the young man. But the second is true. Valerie, though bound to secrecy, has let me guess as much. Besides, she proves it unconsciously in a thousand ways. I believe in heredity, Monsieur Poirot.
I too believe in heredity, said Poirot thoughtfully. I have seen some strange things in connection with it. Moi qui vous parle. But to business, Monsieur le Prince. What do you want of me? What do you fear? I may speak freely, may I not? Is there anything to connect Mademoiselle St. Clair with the crime? She knew Redburn, of course.
Yes, he professed to be in love with her.
And she?
Oh, no. She would have nothing to say to him.
Poirot looked at him keenly. Had she any reason to fear him?
The young man hesitated.
There was an incident. You know Zara, the clairvoyant?
No.
Well, she is wonderful. You should consult her sometime. Valerie and I went to see her last week. She read the cards for us. She spoke to Valerie of trouble, of gathering clouds. Then she turned up the last card, the covering card, they call it. It was the King of Clubs. She said to Valerie, "Beware, there is a man who holds you in his power. You fear him, you are in great danger through him. You know who I mean." Valerie was white to the lips. She nodded and said, "Yes, yes, I know." Shortly afterwards we left. Zara's last words to Valerie were, "Beware of the King of Clubs. Danger threatens you." I questioned Valerie. She would tell me nothing, assured me that all was well. But now, after last night, I am more sure than ever that in the King of Clubs, Valerie saw Redburn, and that he was the man she feared. The prince paused abruptly. "And now you understand my agitation when I opened the paper this morning, supposing Valerie in a fit of madness. Oh, it is impossible."
Poirot rose from his seat and patted the young man kindly on the shoulder.
"Do not distress yourself, I beg of you. Leave it in my hands."
"You will go to Streatham? I gather she is still there at Daisy Mead, prostrated by the shock."
"I will go at once."
"I have arranged matters through the embassy. You will be allowed access everywhere."
"Then we will depart. Hastings, you will accompany me? Au revoir, Monsieur le Prince."
Montdésir was an exceptionally fine villa, thoroughly modern and comfortable. A short carriage drive led up to it from the road, and beautiful gardens extended behind the house for some acres. On mentioning Prince Paul's name, the butler who answered the door at once took us to the scene of the tragedy. The library was a magnificent room, running from back to front of the whole building with a window at either end, one giving on the front carriage drive and the other on the garden. It was in the recess of the latter that the body had lain. It had been removed not long before, the police having concluded their examination.
"That is annoying," I murmured to Poirot. "Who knows what clues they may have destroyed?"
My little friend smiled.
"Ha ha. How often must I tell you that clues come from within? In the little grey cells of the brain lies the solution of every mystery."
He turned to the butler.
"I suppose, except for the removal of the body, the room has not been touched?"
"No, sir. It's just as it was when the police came up last night."
"But these curtains now, I see they pull right across the window recess. They are the same in the other window. Were they drawn last night?"
"Yes, sir. I draw them every night."
"Then Redburn must have drawn them back himself?"
"I suppose so, sir."
"Did you know your master expected a visitor last night?"
"He did not say so, sir. But he gave orders he was not to be disturbed after dinner. You see, sir, there is a door leading out of the library, onto the terrace at the side of the house. He could have admitted anyone that way."
"Was he in the habit of doing that?"
The butler coughed discreetly.
"I believe so, sir."
Poirot strode to the door in question. It was unlocked. He stepped through it onto the terrace which joined the drive on the right. On the left, it led up to a red brick wall.
The fruit garden, sir. There's a door leading into it farther along, but it was always locked at 6 o'clock.
Poirot nodded and re-entered the library, the butler following.
Did you hear nothing of last night's events?
Well, sir, we heard voices in the library a little before 9, but that wasn't unusual, especially being a lady's voice. But, of course, once we were all in the servants' hall right to the other side, we didn't hear anything at all. And then, about 11 o'clock, the police came.
How many voices did you hear?
Well, I couldn't say, sir. I only noticed the ladies.
Ah.
I beg pardon, sir, but Dr. Ryan is still in the house, if you would care to see him.
We jumped at the suggestion, and in a few minutes the doctor, a cheery, middle-aged man, joined us and gave Poirot all the information he required. Redburn had been lying near the window, his head by the marble window seat. There were 2 wounds, one between the eyes and the other, the fatal one, on the back of the head.
He was lying on his back?
Yes, there's the mark. He pointed to a small dark stain on the floor.
Could not a blow on the back of the head have been caused by his striking the floor?
Impossible. Whatever the weapon was, it penetrated some distance into the skull. Poirot looked thoughtfully in front of him. In the embrasure of each window was a carved marble seat, the arms being fashioned in the form of a lion's head. A light came into Poirot's eyes.
Supposing he had fallen backwards on this projecting lion's head and slipped from there to the ground, would not that cause a wound such as you describe?
Yes, it would. But the angle at which he was lying makes that theory impossible, and besides, there could not fail to be traces of blood on the marble of the seat.
Unless they were washed away?
The doctor shrugged his shoulders. But that's hardly likely. It would be to no one's advantage to give an accident the appearance of murder.
Quite so,
acquiesced Poirot.
Could either the blows have been struck by a woman, do you think?
Oh, quite out of the question, I should say. You're thinking of Mademoiselle Sinclair, I suppose.
I am thinking of no one in particular until I am sure,
said Poirot gently. He turned his attention to the open French window, and the doctor continued. It's through here that Mademoiselle Sinclair fled. You can just catch a glimpse of Daisy Mead between the trees. Of course, there are many houses nearer to the front of the house on the road, but as it happens, Daisy Mead, though some distance away, is the only house visible this side.
Thank you for your amiability, Doctor, said Poirot. Come, Hastings, we will follow the footsteps of Mademoiselle.
Poirot led the way down through the garden, out through an iron gate across a short stretch of green, and in through the garden gate of Daisy Mead, which was an unpretentious little house in about 1/2 acre of ground. There was a small flight of steps leading up to a French window. Poirot nodded in their direction.
That is the way Mademoiselle St. Clair went. For us, who have not her urgency to plead, it will be better to go round to the front door.
A maid admitted us and took us into the drawing room, then went in search of Mrs. Oglander. The room had evidently not been touched since the night before. The ashes were still in the grate, and the bridge table was still in the centre of the room with a dummy exposed and the hands thrown down. The place was somewhat overloaded with gimcrack ornaments, and a good many family portraits of surpassing ugliness adorned the walls. Poirot gazed at them more leniently than I did and straightened one or two that were hanging a shade askew.
La famille, it is a strong tie, is it not? Sentiment, it takes the place of beauty.
I agreed, my eyes being fixed on a family group comprising a gentleman with whiskers, a lady with a high front of hair, a stolid, thick-set boy, and 2 little girls tied up with a good many unnecessary bows of ribbon. I took this to be the Oglander family in earlier days and studied it with interest. The door opened and a young woman came in. Her dark hair was neatly arranged and she wore a drab-coloured sports coat and a tweed skirt. She looked at us inquiringly. Poirot stepped forward.
Miss Oglander, I regret to derange you, especially after all you have been through. The whole affair must have been most disturbing.
It has been rather upsetting, admitted the young lady cautiously. I began to think that the elements of drama were wasted on Miss Oglander, that her lack of imagination rose superior to any tragedy. I was confirmed in this belief as she continued. I must apologize for the state the room is in. Servants get so foolishly excited.
It was here that you were sitting last night, n'est-ce pas?
Yes, we were playing bridge after supper when...
Excuse me, how long had you been playing?
Well, Miss Oglander considered. I really can't say. I suppose it must have been about 10 o'clock. We'd had several rubbers, I know.
And you yourself were sitting where?
Facing the window. I was playing with my mother and had gone one no trump. Suddenly, without any warning, the window burst open and Miss St. Clair staggered into the room.
You recognized her?
I had a vague idea her face was familiar.
She is still here, is she not?
Yes, but she refuses to see anyone. She is still quite prostrated.
Oh, I think she will see me. Will you tell her that I am here at the express request of Prince Paul of Morania?
I fancied that the mention of a royal prince rather shook Miss Oglander's imperturbable calm. But she left the room on her errand without any further remark and returned almost immediately to say that Mademoiselle St. Clair would see us in her room. We followed her upstairs and into a fair-sized light bedroom. On a couch by the window, a woman was lying who turned her head as we entered. The contrast between the two women struck me at once, the more so as, in actual features and colouring, they were not unlike, but oh, the difference! Not a look, not a gesture of Valerie St. Clair's, but expressed drama. She seemed to exhale an atmosphere of romance. A scarlet flannel dressing gown covered her feet, a homely garment in all conscience, but the charm of her personality invested it with an exotic flavour, and it seemed an Eastern robe of glowing colour. Her large, dark eyes fastened themselves on Poirot.
"You come from Paul?"
Her voice matched her appearance. It was full and languid.
"Yes, mademoiselle. I am here to serve him and you."
"What do you want to know?"
"Everything that happened last night. Oh, but everything."
She smiled rather wearily.
"Do you think I should lie? I'm not stupid. I see well enough there can be no concealment. He held a secret of mine, that man who is dead. He threatened me with it. For Paul's sake, I endeavoured to make terms with him. I could not risk losing Paul. Now that he is dead, I am safe. But for all that, I did not kill him."
Poirot shook his head with a smile.
"It is not necessary to tell me that, mademoiselle. Now, recount to me what happened last night."
"I offered him money. He appeared to be willing to treat with me. He appointed last night at 9 o'clock. I was to go to Mont Désir. Oh, I knew the place. I'd been there before. I was to go round to the side door into the library so that the servants should not see me."
"Excuse me, mademoiselle, but were you not afraid to trust yourself alone there at night?"
Was it my fancy, or was there a momentary pause before she answered?
Perhaps I was. But you see, there was no one I could ask to go with me, and I was desperate. Redburn admitted me to the library. Oh, that man! I am glad he's dead. He played with me as a cat does with a mouse. He taunted me. I begged and implored him on my knees. I offered him every jewel I have, all in vain. Then he named his own terms, and perhaps you can guess what they were. I refused. I told him what I thought of him. I raved at him. He remained calmly smiling. And then, as I fell to silence at last, there was a sound from behind the curtain in the window. He heard it too. He strode to the curtains and flung them wide apart. There was a man there, hiding, a dreadful-looking man, a sort of tramp. He struck at Mr. Redburn. Then he struck again, and he went down. The tramp clutched at me with his blood-stained hand. I tore myself free, slipped through the window, and ran for my life.
Then I perceived the lights in this house and made for them. I almost fell into the room. I just managed to gasp out, "Murder!" And then everything went black.
Thank you, mademoiselle. It must have been a great shock to your nervous system. As to this tramp, could you describe him? Do you remember what he was wearing?
No, it was all so quick. But I should know the man anywhere. His face is burnt in on my brain.
Just one more question, mademoiselle. The curtains of the other window, the one giving on the drive, were they drawn?
For the first time, a puzzled expression crept over the dancer's face. She seemed to be trying to remember.
Eh bien, mademoiselle?
I think, I'm almost sure. Yes, quite sure. They were not drawn.
Well, that is curious, since the other ones were. No, no matter. It is, I dare say, of no great importance. You are remaining here long, mademoiselle?
The doctor thinks I shall be fit to return to town tomorrow.
She looked round the room. Miss Oglander had gone out.
These people, they're very kind, but they're not of my world. I shock them, and to me, well, I'm not fond of the bourgeoisie.
A faint note of bitterness underlay her words. Poirot nodded.
I understand. I hope I have not fatigued you unduly with my questions.
Oh, not at all, monsieur.
I'm only too anxious Paul should know all as soon as possible. Then I will wish you good day, mademoiselle.
As Poirot was leaving the room, he paused and pounced on a pair of patent leather slippers.
Yours, mademoiselle?
Yes, monsieur, they have just been cleaned and brought up.
Ah,
said Poirot as we descended the stairs.
It seems that the domestics are not too excited to clean shoes, though they forget a grate. Well, mon ami, at first there appeared to be one or two points of interest, but I very much fear, that we must regard the case as finished. It all seems straightforward enough.
And the murderer?
Hercule Poirot does not hunt down tramps, replied my friend grandiloquently.
Miss Oglander met us in the hall. If you will wait in the drawing room a minute, Mama would like to speak to you. The room was still untouched, and Poirot idly gathered up the cards, shuffling them with his tiny, fastidiously groomed hands.
Do you know what I think, my friend?
No, I said eagerly.
I think that Miss Oglander made a mistake in going one note trump. She should have gone three spades.
Oh, Poirot, you are the limit.
Mon Dieu, I cannot always be talking blood and thunder.
Suddenly, he stiffened.
Hastings! Hastings, see! The King of Clubs is missing from the pack.
Zara! I cried.
Eh?
He did not seem to understand my allusion. Mechanically, he stacked the cards and put them away in their cases. His face was very grave.
Hastings, he said at last, I, Hercule Poirot, have come near to make a big mistake, a very big mistake.
I gazed at him, impressed, but utterly uncomprehending.
We must begin again, Hastings, yes, we must begin again, but this time we shall not err.
He was interrupted by the entrance of a handsome, middle-aged lady. She carried some household books in her hand. Poirot bowed to her.
Do I understand, sir, that you are a friend of Miss St. Clair's?
I come from a friend of hers, madame.
Oh, I see. I thought perhaps...
Poirot suddenly waved brusquely at the window.
Your blinds were not pulled down last night.
Oh, no, I suppose that's why Miss St. Clair saw the light so plainly.
But there was moonlight last night. I wonder that you did not see Mademoiselle St. Clair from your seat here facing the windows.
Well, I suppose we were engrossed with our game. Nothing like this has ever happened before to us.
I can't quite believe that, madame, and I will put your mind at rest. Mademoiselle St. Clair is leaving tomorrow.
Oh,
the good lady's face cleared.
And I will wish you good morning, madame.
A servant was cleaning the steps as we went out of the front door. Poirot addressed her.
Was it you who cleaned the shoes of the young lady upstairs?
The maid shook her head.
Oh, no, sir, I don't think they've been cleaned.
Who cleaned them, then? I inquired of Poirot as we walked down the road.
Nobody. They did not need cleaning.
Well, I grant that walking on the road or path on a fine night would not soil them, but surely after going through the long grass of the garden, they would have been soiled and stained.
Yes, said Poirot with a curious smile. In that case, I agree, they would have been stained. But have patience a little half hour, my friend. We are going back to Mondésir.
The butler looked surprised at our reappearance, but offered no objection to our returning to the library. Hi, that's the wrong window, Poirot, I cried as he made for the one overlooking the carriage drive.
I think not, my friend. See here.
He pointed to the marble lion's head. On it was a faint, discoloured smear. He shifted his finger and pointed to a similar stain on the polished floor.
Someone struck Redburn with a blow with his clenched fist between the eyes. He fell backwards on this projecting bit of marble, then slipped to the floor. Afterwards, he was dragged across the floor to the other window and laid there instead, but not quite at the same angle as the doctor's evidence told us.
But why? It seems utterly unnecessary.
On the contrary, it was essential. Also, it is the key to the murderer's identity. Though, by the way, he had no intention of killing Redburn, so it is hardly permissible to call him a murderer. He must be a very strong man.
Well, because of having dragged the body across the floor?
Not altogether. It has been an interesting case. I nearly made an imbecile of myself, though.
What do you mean to say it's over, that you know everything?
Yes.
A remembrance smote me.
Oh, no, I cried. There's one thing you do not know.
And that?
You do not know where the missing King of Clubs is.
Eh? Oh, that is droll. That is very droll, my friend.
Why?
Because it is in my pocket.
He drew it forth with a flourish. Oh, I said rather crestfallen. Where did you find it? Here?
No, there was nothing sensational about it. It had simply not been taken out with the other cards. It was in the box.
Oh. Well, all the same, it gave you an idea, didn't it?
Yes, my friend. I present my respects to His Majesty.
And to Madame Zara?
Oh, yes, to the lady also.
Well, what are we going to do now?
We are going to return to town, but I must have a few words with a certain lady at Desimid first.
The same little maid opened the door to us.
They're all at lunch now, sir, unless it's Miss St. Clair you want to see, and she's resting. It will do if I can see Mrs. Oglander for a few minutes. Will you tell her?
We were led into the drawing room to wait. I had a glimpse of the family in the dining room as we passed, now reinforced by the presence of two heavy, solid-looking men, one with a moustache, the other with a beard also. In a few minutes, Mrs. Oglander came into the room looking inquiringly at Poirot, who bowed.
Madame, we in our country have a great tenderness, a great respect for the mother, the mère de famille. She is everything.
Mrs. Oglander looked rather astonished at this opening.
It is for that reason that I have come, to allay a mother's anxiety. The murderer of Mr. Redburn will not be discovered, have no fear. I, Hercule Poirot, tell you so. I am right, am I not? Or is it a wife that I must reassure?
There was a moment's pause. Mrs. Oglander seemed searching Poirot with her eyes. At last she said quietly,
I don't know how you know, but yes, you are right.
Poirot nodded gravely.
That is all, madame. But do not be uneasy. Your English policemen have not the eyes of Hercule Poirot.
He tapped the family portrait on the wall with his fingernail.
You had another daughter once. She is dead, madame.
Again there was a pause as she searched him with her eyes. Then she answered,
Yes, she is dead.
Ah, said Poirot briskly.
Well, we must return to town. You permitted I return the King of Clubs to the pack? It was your only slip. You understand, to have played bridge for an hour or so with only 51 cards? Well, no one who knows anything of the game would credit it for a minute. Bonjour.
And now, my friend, said Poirot as we stepped towards the station, you see it all.
I see nothing. Who killed Reedburn?
John Oglander, Jr. I was not quite sure if it was the father or the son, but I fixed on the son as being the stronger and younger of the two. It had to be one of them because of the window.
Why?
There were four exits from the library. Two doors, two windows. But evidently only one would do. Three exits gave on the front, directly or indirectly. The tragedy had to occur in the back window in order to make it appear that Valerie St. Clair came to Daisy Mead by chance. Really, of course, she fainted, and John Oglander carried her across over his shoulders. That is why I said he must be a strong man.
Did they go there together, then?
Yes. You remember Valerie's hesitation when I asked her if she was not afraid to go alone? John Oglander went with her, which didn't improve Reedburn's temper, I fancy. They quarrelled, and it was probably some insult levelled at Valerie that made Oglander hit him. The rest you know.
But why the bridge?
Bridge presupposes four players. A simple thing like that carries a lot of conviction. Who would have supposed that there had been only three people in that room all evening?
I was still puzzled. Now, there's one thing I don't understand. What have the Oglanders to do with the dancer, Valerie St. Clair?
Ah, that I wonder you did not see. And yet you looked long enough at a picture on the wall, longer than I did. Mrs. Oglander's other daughter may be dead to her family, but the world knows her as Valerie St. Clair.
What?
Did you not see the resemblance the moment you saw the two sisters together?
Well, no, I confessed. I only thought how extraordinarily dissimilar they were.
Ah, that is because your mind is so open to external romantic impressions, my dear Hastings. Their features are almost identical, so is the colouring. The interesting thing is that Valerie is ashamed of her family, and her family is ashamed of her. Nevertheless, in a moment of peril, she turned to her brother for help, and when things went wrong, they all hung together in a remarkable way. Family strength is a marvelous thing. They can all act, that family. That is where Valerie gets her histrionic talent from. I, like Prince Paul, believe in heredity. They deceived me. But for a lucky accident and test question to Mrs. Oglander, by which I got her to contradict her daughter's account of how they were sitting, the Oglander family would have put a defeat on Hercule Poirot.
But what shall you tell the prince?
That Valerie could not possibly have committed the crime, and that I doubt if that tramp will ever be found. Also, to convey my compliments to Zara, a curious coincidence that. I think I shall call this little affair the adventure of the King of Clubs. What do you think, my friend?
The Face of Helen. Mr. Satterthwaite was at the opera and sat alone in his big box on the first tier. Outside the door was a printed card bearing his name. An appreciator and a connoisseur of all the arts, Mr. Satterthwaite was especially fond of good music and was a regular subscriber to Covent Garden, every year reserving a box for Tuesdays and Fridays throughout the season. But it was not often that he sat in it alone. He was a gregarious little gentleman, and he liked filling his box with the elite of the world to which he belonged, and also with the aristocracy of the artistic world, in which he was equally at home. He was alone tonight because a countess had disappointed him. The countess, besides being a beautiful and celebrated woman, was also a good mother. Her children had been attacked by that common and distressing disease, the mumps, and the countess remained at home in tearful confabulation with exquisitely starched nurses. Her husband, who had supplied her with the aforementioned children and a title, but who was otherwise a complete non-entity, had seized at the chance to escape. Nothing bored him more than music. So Mr. Satterthwaite sat alone. Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci were being given that night, and since the first had never appealed to him, he arrived just after the curtain went down on Santuzza's death agony, in time to glance round the house with practiced eyes, before everyone streamed out, bent on paying visits or fighting for coffee or lemonade. Mr. Satterthwaite adjusted his opera glasses, looked round the house, marked down his prey, and sallied forth with a well-mapped-out plan of campaign ahead of him. A plan, however, which he did not put into execution, for just outside his box he cannoned into a tall, dark man and recognized him with a pleasurable thrill of excitement. "Mr. Quinn," cried Mr. Satterthwaite. He seized his friend warmly by the hand, clutching him as though he feared at any minute to see him vanish into thin air. "You must cheer my box," said Mr. Satterthwaite determinedly. "You are not with a party?" "No, I am sitting by myself in the stalls," responded Mr. Quinn with a smile. "Then that is settled," said Mr. Satterthwaite with a sigh of relief. His manner was almost comic, had there been anyone to observe it. "You are very kind," said Mr. Quinn. "Not at all, it is a pleasure. I didn't know you were fond of music." "There are reasons why I am attracted to Pagliacci." "Ah, of course," said Mr. Satterthwaite, nodding sapiently, though, if put to it, he would have found it hard to explain just why he had used that expression. "Of course you would be." They went back to the box at the first summons of the bell, and leaning over the front of it, they watched the people returning to the stalls. "That's a beautiful head," observed Mr. Satterthwaite suddenly. He indicated with his glasses a spot immediately beneath them in the stalls' circle. A girl sat there, whose face they could not see, only the pure gold of her hair that fitted with the closeness of a cap till it merged into the white neck. "A Greek head," said Mr. Satterthwaite reverently. "Pure Greek." He sighed happily. "It is a remarkable thing, when you come to think of it, how very few people have hair that fits them. It's more noticeable now that everyone is shingled." "You are so observant," said Mr. Quinn. "I see things," admitted Mr. Satterthwaite. "I do see things. For instance, I picked out that head at once. We must have a look at her face sooner or later, but it won't match, I'm sure. That would be a chance in a thousand." Almost as the words left his lips, the lights flickered and went down. The sharp rap of the conductor's baton was heard, and the opera began. A new tenor, said to be a second Caruso, was singing that night. He had been referred to by the newspapers as a Yugoslav, a Czech, an Albanian, a Magyar, and a Bulgarian, with a beautiful impartiality. He had given an extraordinary concert at the Albert Hall, a program of the folk songs of his native hills with a specially tuned orchestra. They were in strange half-tones, and the would-be musical had pronounced them too marvelous. Real musicians had reserved judgment, realizing that the ear had to be specially trained and attuned before any criticism was possible. It was quite a relief to some people to find this evening that Joachim could sing in ordinary Italian, with all the traditional sobs and quivers. The curtain went down on the first act, and applause burst out vociferously. Mr. Satterthwaite turned to Mr. Quinn. He realized that the latter was waiting for him to pronounce judgment, and plumed himself a little. After all, he knew. As a critic, he was well-nigh infallible. Very slowly, he nodded his head. "It is the real thing," he said. "You think so?" "As fine a voice as Caruso's. People will not recognize that it is so at first, for his technique is not yet perfect. There are ragged edges, a lack of certainty in the attack, but the voice is there. Magnificent." "I went to his concert at the Albert Hall," said Mr. Quinn. "Did you? I could not go. He made a wonderful hit with a shepherd's song." "I read about it," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "The refrain ends each time with a high note, a kind of cry. A note midway between A and B flat. Very curious." Joachim had taken three calls, bowing and smiling. The lights went up, and the people began to file out. Mr. Satterthwaite leant over to watch the girl with the golden head. She rose, adjusted her scarf, and turned. Mr. Satterthwaite caught his breath. There were, he knew, such faces in the world, faces that made history. The girl moved to the gangway, her companion, a young man, beside her. and Mr. Satterthwaite noticed how every man in the vicinity looked, and continued to look covertly. "Beauty," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. "There is such a thing. Not charm, nor attraction, nor magnetism, nor any of the things we talk about so glibly. Just sheer beauty. The shape of a face, the line of an eyebrow, the curve of a jaw." He quoted softly under his breath, "The face that launched a thousand ships." And for the first time he realized the meaning of those words. He glanced across at Mr. Quinn, who was watching him in what seemed such perfect comprehension that Mr. Satterthwaite felt there was no need for words. "I've always wondered," he said simply, "what such women were really like." "You mean? The Helens, the Cleopatras, the Mary Stuarts." Mr. Quinn nodded thoughtfully. "If we go out," he suggested, "we may see." They went out together, and their quest was successful. The pair they were in search of were seated on a lounge halfway up the staircase. For the first time, Mr. Satterthwaite noted the girl's companion, a dark young man, not handsome, but with a suggestion of restless fire about him, a face full of strange angles, jutting cheekbones, a forceful, slightly crooked jaw, deep-set eyes that were curiously light under the dark, overhanging brows. "An interesting face," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. "A real face. It means something." The young man was leaning forward, talking earnestly. The girl was listening. Neither of them belonged to Mr. Satterthwaite's world. He took them to be of the arty class. The girl wore a rather shapeless garment of cheap green silk. Her shoes were of soiled white satin. The young man wore his evening clothes with an air of being uncomfortable in them. The two men passed and repassed several times. The fourth time they did so, the couple had been joined by a third, a fair young man with a suggestion of the clerk about him. With his coming, a certain tension had set in. The newcomer was fidgeting with his tie and seemed ill at ease. The girl's beautiful face was turned gravely up towards him, and her companion was scowling furiously. "The usual story," said Mr. Quinn very softly as they passed. "Yes," said Mr. Satterthwaite with a sigh. "It is inevitable, I suppose. The snarling of two dogs over a bone. It always has been. It always will be. And yet one could wish for something different. Beauty." He stopped. Beauty, to Mr. Satterthwaite, meant something very wonderful. He found it difficult to speak of it. He looked at Mr. Quinn, who nodded his head gravely in understanding. They went back to their seats for the second act. At the close of the performance, Mr. Satterthwaite turned eagerly to his friend. "It is a wet night. My car is here. You must allow me to drive you somewhere." The last word was Mr. Satterthwaite's delicacy coming into play. To drive you home would, he felt, have savoured of curiosity. Mr. Quinn had always been singularly reticent. It was extraordinary how little Mr. Satterthwaite knew about him. "But perhaps," continued the little man, "you have your own car waiting." "No," said Mr. Quinn, "I have no car waiting." "Then..." But Mr. Quinn shook his head. "You are most kind," he said, "but I prefer to go my own way. Besides," he said with a rather curious smile, "if anything should happen, it will be for you to act. Good night, and thank you. Once again, we have seen the drama together." He had gone so quickly that Mr. Satterthwaite had no time to protest, but he was left with a faint uneasiness stirring in his mind. To what drama did Mr. Quinn refer? Pagliacci? Or another? Masters, Mr. Satterthwaite's chauffeur, was in the habit of waiting in a side street. His master disliked the long delay while the cars drew up in turn before the opera house. Now, as on previous occasions, he walked rapidly round the corner and along the street towards where he knew he should find Masters awaiting him. Just in front of him were a girl and a man, and even as he recognized them, another man joined them. It all broke out in a minute. A man's voice, angrily uplifted, another man's voice in injured protest, and then the scuffle, blows, angry breathing, more blows, the form of a policeman appearing majestically from nowhere. And in another minute, Mr. Satterthwaite was beside the girl as she shrank back against the wall.
"Allow me," he said. "You must not stay here."
He took her by the arm and marshalled her swiftly down the street. Once she looked back.
"Oughtn't I?"
she began uncertainly. Mr. Satterthwaite shook his head.
"It would be very unpleasant for you to be mixed up in it. You would probably be asked to go along to the police station with them. I am sure neither of your friends would wish that."
He stopped.
This is my car. If you will allow me to do so, I shall have much pleasure in driving you home."
The girl looked at him searchingly. The staid respectability of Mr. Satterthwaite impressed her favorably. She bent her head.
"Thank you,"
she said, and got into the car, the door of which Masters was holding open. In reply to a question from Mr. Satterthwaite, she gave an address in Chelsea, and he got in beside her. The girl was upset, and not in the mood for talking, and Mr. Satterthwaite was too tactful to intrude upon her thoughts. Presently, however, she turned to him and spoke of her own accord.
"I wish," she said pettishly, "people wouldn't be so silly."
"It is a nuisance," agreed Mr. Satterthwaite. His matter-of-fact manner put her at her ease, and she went on as though feeling the need of confiding in someone.
"It wasn't as though, I mean, well, it was like this. Mr. Eastney and I have been friends for a long time, ever since I came to London. He's taken no end of trouble about my voice and got me some very good introductions, and he's been more kind to me than I can say. He's absolutely music mad. It was very good of him to take me tonight. I'm sure he can't really afford it. And then Mr. Burns came up and spoke to us, quite nicely, I'm sure. And Phil, Mr. Eastney, got sulky about it. I don't know why he should. It's a free country, I'm sure. And Mr. Burns is always pleasant and good-tempered. Then just as we were walking to the tube, he came up and joined us. And he hadn't so much as said two words before Philip flew out at him like a madman, and I don't like it."
"Don't you?" asked Mr. Satterthwaite very softly. She blushed, but very little. There was none of the conscious siren about her. A certain measure of pleasurable excitement in being fought for there must be, that was only nature. But Mr. Satterthwaite decided that a worried perplexity lay uppermost, and he had the clue to it in another moment when she observed inconsequently, "I do hope he hasn't hurt him."
"Now, which is him?"
thought Mr. Satterthwaite, smiling to himself in the darkness. He backed his own judgment and said,
"You hope Mr. Eastney hasn't hurt Mr. Burns?"
She nodded.
"Yes, that's what I said. It seems so dreadful. I wish I knew."
The car was drawing up.
"Are you on the telephone?"
he asked.
"Yes." "If you like, I will find out exactly what has happened and then telephone to you."
The girl's face brightened.
"Oh, that would be very kind of you. Are you sure it's not too much bother?"
"Not in the least." She thanked him again and gave him her telephone number, adding with a touch of shyness,
"My name is Gillian West."
As he was driven through the night, bound on his errand, a curious smile came to Mr. Satterthwaite's lips. He thought, "So, that is all it is. The shape of a face, the curve of a jaw." But he fulfilled his promise. The following Sunday afternoon, Mr. Satterthwaite went to Kew Gardens to admire the rhododendrons. Very long ago, incredibly long ago, it seemed to Mr. Satterthwaite, he had driven down to Kew Gardens with a certain young lady to see the bluebells. Mr. Satterthwaite had arranged very carefully beforehand, in his own mind, exactly what he was going to say, and the precise words he would use in asking the young lady for her hand in marriage. He was just conning them over in his mind, and responding to her raptures about the bluebells a little absent-mindedly, when the shock came. The young lady stopped exclaiming at the bluebells, and suddenly confided in Mr. Satterthwaite, as a true friend, her love for another. Mr. Satterthwaite put away the little set speech he had prepared and hastily rummaged for sympathy and friendship in the bottom drawer of his mind. Such was Mr. Satterthwaite's romance, a rather tepid early Victorian one, but it had left him with a romantic attachment to Kew Gardens, and he would often go there to see the bluebells, or, if he had been abroad later than usual, the rhododendrons, and would sigh to himself and feel rather sentimental, and really enjoy himself very much indeed in an old-fashioned, romantic way. This particular afternoon, he was strolling back past the tea-houses when he recognized a couple sitting at one of the small tables on the grass. They were Gillian West and the fair young man, and at that moment they recognized him. He saw the girl flush and speak eagerly to her companion. In another minute he was shaking hands with them both in his correct, rather prim fashion, and had accepted the shy invitation proffered to him to have tea with them. "I can't tell you, sir," said Mr. Burns, "how grateful I am to you for looking after Gillian the other night. She told me all about it."
"Yes, indeed," said the girl. "It was ever so kind of you."
Mr. Satterthwaite felt pleased and interested in the pair. Their naivety and sincerity touched him. Also, it was to him a peep into a world with which he was not well acquainted. These people were of a class unknown to him. In his little dried-up way, Mr. Satterthwaite could be very sympathetic. Very soon he was hearing all about his new friends. He noted that Mr. Burns had become Charlie, and he was not unprepared for the statement that the two were engaged. "As a matter of fact," said Mr. Burns, with refreshing candor, "it just happened this afternoon, didn't it, Jill?" Burns was a clerk in a shipping firm. He was making a fair salary, had a little money of his own, and the two proposed to be married quite soon. Mr. Satterthwaite listened and nodded and congratulated. "An ordinary young man," he thought to himself. "A very ordinary young man. Nice, straightforward young chap. Plenty to say for himself. Good opinion of himself without being conceited. Nice looking without being unduly handsome. Nothing remarkable about him, and will never set the Thames on fire. And the girl loves him." Aloud he said, "And Mr. Eastney?" He purposely broke off, but he had said enough to produce an effect for which he was not unprepared. Charlie Burns' face darkened, and Gillian looked troubled. More than troubled, he thought. She looked afraid. "I don't like it," she said in a low voice. Her words were addressed to Mr. Satterthwaite, as though she knew by instinct that he would understand a feeling incomprehensible to her lover.
"You see, he's done a lot for me. He's encouraged me to take up singing and helped me with it. But I've known all the time that my voice wasn't really good. Not first class. Of course, I've had engagements." She stopped.
"You've had a bit of trouble, too," said Burns. "A girl wants someone to look after her. Gillian's had a lot of unpleasantness, Mr. Satterthwaite. Altogether, she's had a lot of unpleasantness. She's a good looker, as you can see, and, well, that often leads to trouble for a girl."
Between them, Mr. Satterthwaite became enlightened as to various happenings, which were vaguely classed by Burns under the heading of unpleasantness. A young man who had shot himself, the extraordinary conduct of a bank manager who was a married man, a violent stranger who must have been balmy, the wild behavior of an elderly artist, a trail of violence and tragedy that Gillian West had left in her wake, recited in the commonplace tones of Charlie Burns. "And it's my opinion," he ended, "that this fellow Eastney is a bit cracked. Gillian would have had trouble with him if I hadn't turned up to look after her."
His laugh sounded a little fatuous to Mr. Satterthwaite, and no responsive smile came to the girl's face. She was looking earnestly at Mr. Satterthwaite.
"Phil's all right," she said slowly. "He cares for me. I know, and I care for him like a friend, but not anything more. I don't know how he'll take the news about Charlie, I'm sure. I'm so afraid he'll be..."
She stopped, inarticulate in the face of the dangers she vaguely sensed.
"If I can help you in any way," said Mr. Satterthwaite warmly, "pray command me."
He fancied Charlie Burns looked vaguely resentful, but Gillian at once said,
"Thank you."
Mr. Satterthwaite left his new friends after having promised to take tea with Gillian on the following Thursday. When Thursday came, Mr. Satterthwaite felt a little thrill of pleasurable anticipation. He thought, I'm an old man, but not too old to be thrilled by a face. A face? Then he shook his head with a sense of foreboding. Gillian was alone. Charlie Burns was to come in later. She looked much happier, Mr. Satterthwaite thought, as though a load had been lifted from her mind. Indeed, she frankly admitted as much. I dreaded telling Phil about Charles. It was silly of me. I ought to have known Phil better. Well, he was upset, of course, but no one could have been sweeter. Really sweet he was. Look what he sent me this morning. A wedding present. Isn't it magnificent? It was indeed rather magnificent for a young man in Philip Eastney's circumstances. A four-valve wireless set of the latest type. We both love music so much, you see, explained the girl. Phil said that when I was listening to a concert on this, I should always think of him a little, and I'm sure I shall, because we've been such friends. You must be proud of your friend, said Mr. Satterthwaite gently. He seems to have taken the blow like a true sportsman. Gillian nodded. He saw the quick tears come into her eyes. He asked me to do one thing for him. Tonight is the anniversary of the day we first met. He asked me if I would stay at home quietly this evening and listen to the wireless program. Not to go out with Charlie anywhere. But I said of course I would, that I was very touched, that I would think of him with a lot of gratitude and affection. Mr. Satterthwaite nodded, but he was puzzled. He was seldom at fault in his delineation of character, and he would have judged Philip Eastney quite incapable of such a sentimental request. The young man must be of a more banal order than he supposed. Gillian evidently thought the idea quite in keeping with her rejected lover's character. Mr. Satterthwaite was a little, just a little, disappointed. He was sentimental himself and knew it, but he expected better things of the rest of the world. Besides, sentiment belonged to his age. It had no part to play in the modern world. He asked Gillian to sing, and she complied. He told her her voice was charming, but he knew quite well in his own mind that it was distinctly second class. Any success that could have come to her in the profession she had adopted would have been won by her face, not her voice. He was not particularly anxious to see young Burns again, so presently he rose to go. It was at that moment that his attention was attracted by an ornament on the mantelpiece, which stood out among the other, rather gimcrack objects, like a jewel on a dust heap. It was a curving beaker of thin green glass, long-stemmed and graceful, and poised on the edge of it was what looked like a gigantic soap bubble, a ball of iridescent glass. Gillian noticed his absorption. Well, that's an extra wedding present from Phil. It's rather pretty, I think. He works in a sort of glass factory. It is a beautiful thing, said Mr. Satterthwaite reverently. The glass blowers of Murano might have been proud of that. He went away with his interest in Philip Eastney, strangely stimulated. An extraordinarily interesting young man. And yet the girl with the wonderful face preferred Charlie Burns. What a strange and inscrutable universe. It had just occurred to Mr. Satterthwaite that owing to the remarkable beauty of Gillian West, his evening with Mr. Quinn had somehow misfired. As a rule, every meeting with that mysterious individual had resulted in some strange and unforeseen happening. It was with the hope of perhaps running against the man of mystery that Mr. Satterthwaite bent his steps towards the Arlecchino restaurant, where once, in the days gone by, he had met Mr. Quinn, and which Mr. Quinn had said he often frequented. Mr. Satterthwaite went from room to room at the Arlecchino, looking hopefully about him, but there was no sign of Mr. Quinn's dark, smiling face. There was, however, somebody else. Sitting at a small table alone was Philip Eastney. The place was crowded, and Mr. Satterthwaite took his seat opposite the young man. He felt a sudden, strange sense of exaltation, as though he were caught up and made part of a shimmering pattern of events. He was in this thing, whatever it was. He knew now what Mr. Quinn had meant that evening at the opera. There was a drama going on, and in it was a part, an important part for Mr. Satterthwaite. He must not fail to take his cue and speak his lines. He sat down opposite Philip Eastney with the sense of accomplishing the inevitable. It was easy enough to get into conversation. Eastney seemed anxious to talk. Mr. Satterthwaite was, as always, an encouraging and sympathetic listener. They talked of the war, of explosives, of poison gases. Eastney had a lot to say about these last, for during the greater part of the war he had been engaged in their manufacture. Mr. Satterthwaite found him really interesting. There was one gas, Eastney said, that had never been tried. The armistice had come too soon. Great things had been hoped for it. One whiff of it was deadly. He warmed to animation as he spoke. Having broken the ice, Mr. Satterthwaite gently turned the conversation to music. Eastney's thin face lit up. He spoke with the passion and abandon of the real music lover. They discussed Joachim, and the young man was enthusiastic. Both he and Mr. Satterthwaite agreed that nothing on earth could surpass a really fine tenor voice. Eastney, as a boy, had heard Caruso, and he had never forgotten it. "Do you know that he could sing to a wine glass and shatter it?" he demanded. "I always thought that was a fable," said Mr. Satterthwaite, smiling. "No, it's gospel truth, I believe. The thing's quite possible. It's a question of resonance." He went off into technical details. His face was flushed, and his eyes shone. The subject seemed to fascinate him, and Mr. Satterthwaite noted that he seemed to have a thorough grasp of what he was talking about. The elder man realized that he was talking to an exceptional brain, a brain that might almost be described as that of a genius. Brilliant, erratic, undecided as yet as to the true channel to give it outlet, but undoubtedly genius. And he thought of Charlie Burns, and wondered at Gillian West. It was with quite a start that he realized how late it was getting, and he called for his bill. Eastney looked slightly apologetic. I'm ashamed of myself, running on so, he said. But it was a lucky chance, sent you along here tonight. I needed someone to talk to this evening. He ended his speech with a curious little laugh. His eyes were still blazing with some subdued excitement. Yet there was something tragic about him. "It has been quite a pleasure," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "Our conversation has been most interesting and instructive to me." He then made his funny, courteous little bow and passed out of the restaurant. The night was a warm one, and as he walked slowly down the street, a very odd fancy came to him. He had the feeling that he was not alone, that someone was walking by his side. In vain, he told himself that the idea was a delusion. It persisted. Someone was walking beside him down that dark, quiet street. Someone whom he could not see. He wondered what it was that brought the figure of Mr. Quinn so clearly before his mind. He felt exactly as though Mr. Quinn were there, walking beside him. And yet, he had only to use his eyes to assure himself that it was not so, that he was alone. But the thought of Mr. Quinn persisted. And with it came something else. A need. An urgency of some kind. An oppressive foreboding of calamity. There was something he must do, and do quickly. There was something very wrong, and it lay in his hands to put it right. So strong was the feeling that Mr. Satterthwaite forbore to fight against it. Instead, he shut his eyes and tried to bring that mental image of Mr. Quinn nearer. If he could only have asked Mr. Quinn, but even as the thought flashed through his mind, he knew it was wrong. It was never any use asking Mr. Quinn anything. "The threads are all in your hands," that was the kind of thing Mr. Quinn would say. The threads? Well, threads of what? He analyzed his own feeling and impressions carefully. That presentiment of danger now. Whom did it threaten? At once a picture rose up before his eyes. The picture of Gillian West, sitting alone, listening to the wireless. Mr. Satterthwaite flung a penny to a passing newspaper boy and snatched at a paper. He turned at once to the London radio program. Joachim was broadcasting tonight, he noted with interest. He was singing Salve de Mora from Faust and afterwards a selection of his folk songs, the shepherd song, the fish, the little deer, etc. Mr. Satterthwaite crumpled the paper together. The knowledge of what Gillian was listening to seemed to make the picture of her clearer. Sitting there, alone. An odd request, that, of Philip Eastney's. Not like the man. Not like him at all. There was no sentimentality in Eastney. He was a man of violent feeling. A dangerous man, perhaps. Again, his thought brought him up with a jerk. A dangerous man. That meant something. The threads are all in your hands. That meeting with Philip Eastney tonight. Rather odd. A lucky chance, Eastney had said. Was it chance? Or was it part of that interwoven design of which Mr. Satterthwaite had once or twice been conscious this evening? He cast his mind back. There must be something in Eastney's conversation. Some clue there. There must. Or else why this strange feeling of urgency? What had he talked about? Singing. War work. Caruso. Caruso. Mr. Satterthwaite's thoughts went off at a tangent. Joachim's voice was very nearly equal to that of Caruso. Gillian would be sitting listening to it now, as it rang out, true and powerful, echoing round the room, setting glasses ringing. He caught his breath. Glasses ringing. Caruso singing to a wine glass and the wine glass breaking. Joachim singing in the London studio, and in a room over a mile away, the crash and tinkle of glass, not a wine glass. A thin, green glass beaker, a crystal soap bubble falling, a soap bubble that perhaps was not empty. It was at that moment that Mr. Satterthwaite, as judged by passers-by, suddenly went mad. He tore open the newspaper once more, took a brief glance at the wireless announcements, and then began to run for his life down the quiet street. At the end of it, he found a crawling taxi, and jumping into it, he yelled an address to the driver and the information that it was life or death to get him there quickly. The driver, judging him mentally afflicted, but rich, did his utmost. Mr. Satterthwaite lay back, his head a jumble of fragmentary thoughts, forgotten bits of science learned at school, phrases used by Eastney that night. Resonance, natural periods. If the period of the force coincides with the natural period, there was something about a suspension bridge, soldiers marching over it and the swing of their stride being the same as the period of the bridge. Eastney had studied the subject. Eastney knew, and Eastney was a genius. At 10:45, Joachim was to broadcast. It was that now. Yes, but the Faust had to come first. It was the shepherd song with the great shout after the refrain that would... Do what? His mind went whirling round again. Tones, overtones, half-tones. He didn't know much about these things, but Eastney knew. Pray heaven he would be in time. The taxi stopped. Mr. Satterthwaite flung himself out and raced up the stone stairs to the second floor like a young athlete. The door of the flat was ajar. He pushed it open, and the great tenor voice welcomed him. The words of the shepherd's song were familiar to him in a less unconventional setting. Shepherd, see thy horse's flowing mane. He was in time then. He burst open the sitting room door. Gillian was sitting there in a tall chair by the fireplace. Beira, Misha's daughter, is to wed today. To the wedding I must haste away. She must have thought him mad. He clutched at her, crying out something incomprehensible, and half-pulled, half-dragged her out till they stood upon the stairway. To the wedding I must haste away. Ya, ya! A wonderful high note. Full-throated, powerful, hit full in the middle, a note any singer might be proud of. And with it, another sound. The faint tinkle of broken glass. A stray cat darted past them, and in through the flat door. Gillian made a movement. But Mr. Satterthwaite held her back, speaking incoherently. No, no, no! It's deadly! No smell, nothing to warn you. A mere whiff and it's all over. Nobody knows quite how deadly it would be. It's unlike anything that's ever been tried before. He was repeating the things that Philip Eastney had told him over the table at dinner. Gillian stared at him uncomprehendingly. Philip Eastney drew out his watch and looked at it. It was just 11:30. For the past 3/4 hour, he had been pacing up and down the embankment. He looked out over the Thames, and then turned, to look into the face of his dinner companion. "That's odd," he said, and laughed. "We seem fated to run into each other tonight." "If you call it fate," said Mr. Satterthwaite. Philip Eastney looked at him more attentively, and his own expression changed. Yes, he said quietly. Mr. Satterthwaite went straight to the point.
I have just come from Miss West's flat.
Yes,
the same voice with the same deadly quiet. We have taken a dead cat out of it.
There was a silence. Then Eastney said,
Who are you?
Mr. Satterthwaite spoke for some time. He recited the whole history of events.
So, you see, I was in time,
he ended up. He paused and added quite gently,
Have you anything to say?
He expected something, some outburst, some wild justification. But nothing came. No, said Philip Eastney quietly, and turned on his heel and walked away. Mr. Satterthwaite looked after him till his figure was swallowed up in the gloom. In spite of himself, he had a strange fellow feeling for Eastney, the feeling of an artist for another artist, of a sentimentalist for a real lover, of a plain man for a genius. At last he roused himself with a start and began to walk in the same direction as Eastney. A fog was beginning to come up. Presently he met a policeman, who looked at him suspiciously.
Did you hear a kind of splash just now, sir?
Asked the policeman.
No,
said Mr. Satterthwaite. The policeman was peering out over the river.
Another of these suicides, I expect,
he grunted disconsolately.
They will do it.
I suppose, said Mr. Satterthwaite, that they have their reasons.
Money, mostly, said the policeman.
Sometimes it's a woman,
he said, as he prepared to move away.
It's not always their fault.
But some women cause a lot of trouble.
Some women, agreed Mr. Satterthwaite softly. When the policeman had gone on, he sat down on a seat with the fog coming up all around him and thought about Helen of Troy and wondered if she were a nice, ordinary woman, blessed or cursed, with a wonderful face.